Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
Fiction writers refer to a character's backstory. The history and background that form the character's worldview and provide the foundation of the character's motivations. Structures have backstories as well, sometimes stretching over centuries and involving wars, intrigues, disasters, and bizarre characters. From the cathedral at Chartres to the Great Wall of China, the world is full of beautiful and impressive structures with an inside story that few know about. Some of these structures, such as the Eiffel Tower, are known to almost everyone. Others, such as the Kowloon-walled city, are much less well-known, and countless other structures are almost completely ignored by all but a few. But all have their stories and their secrets. John Reisinger, in his recent book, The Secrets Behind the Structures. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. My guest today is John Reisinger, and we're talking about his new book, The Secrets Behind the Structures. John is a prolific writer, having written some 15 books, at least by my count, including historical novels, nonfiction works, and historical mysteries. John, you've been on the program a number of times now, I believe. Twice, I think. And I want to welcome you back to talk about this latest book of yours. I know you're a writer of mysteries, and I find that this book is also a book of mysteries in its own right. Welcome, John, to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition.
Thank you, Al.
John, tell us about your book and how you came to write it.
Well, I think you summed it up pretty well. Buildings and structures have backstories. When you see one, you have an impression of it, but you have no idea what went into it, what sort of things happened in and around it. And some of these stories are kind of interesting and bizarre and involve people, some of which are well-known, some of which aren't. As far as the idea, we were on vacation in the Bahamas years ago. We're wandering around Nassau, and we came upon a large lot which was overgrown with tropical vegetation, and it had a pathway going into it. And naturally, we went to follow the pathway, and there was the ruins, burned-out ruins, of a huge structure, bigger than anything else in Nassau. You see the windows was concrete one time. And I found out it was the ruins of the Royal Victoria Hotel, which had been built in 1860 in anticipation of American tourists coming down. Well, the Civil War came along, so Americans had other things to do, so it sat empty for a while until the blockade runners started using Nassau as a transfer port because it was a neutral country, supposedly. And it became the center of a lot of very well-off people who were coming, because they were very well paid if they survived, running the blockade. So it was a generator of revenue, which resulted in all the streets being paved and the streetlights and everything else, and the debt being paid off in the Bahamas, which was still a British colony. So I thought this was kind of an interesting story, because when you talk to the tour guides down there, all you hear about are the pirates, which are, you know, interesting enough. But this was something directly involving Americans and the Civil War, which you never hear about. So I looked it up and got some information on it. I wound up writing a book about it. But it was just the first of a lot of different places that I found had long and involved and interesting stories behind them. So from that, I've been collecting these really for years and finally put them in a book.
How many of these places have you, that you're right about, John, have you been to? Were you able to visit very many of them?
I'd say probably about a half, something like that. But there's some, one of them's in North Korea, so I didn't get there. But I've been to a number of them, and probably as many as I could have. Some of them, as I say, are not quite so accessible. Some of them don't exist anymore. So I didn't visit any of them.
Yeah, I noticed a few vacant lots.
Yes, yeah.
In your stories.
Yes, including a couple of local places. I mentioned the Safeway store in Easton. The store is there, but the building I'm writing about was where the parking lot is now.
Tell us a little bit about the Safeway store then.
Well, that is something almost no one knows about because it's pretty unpretentious. But right in downtown Easton, on the Eastern Shore, there is a Safeway store, which has since closed. The building is still there, and it's going to be made into something. On the parking lot used to stand a church. It was the Calvary Methodist Episcopal Church. And in 1928, it was the scene of a Hollywood wedding between Faye Ray, who was the lady who was famous from King Kong fame, although that would be a few years later, and a screenwriter by the name of Montgomery, and the best man was Gary Cooper, right in the Middle East. And the reason that happened was that Paramount Pictures was filming a silent movie called The First Kiss, which is about a waterman played by Gary Cooper, and they were filming it in St. Michael's. And Faye Ray and her screenwriter friend decided they didn't want to wait till they got back to Hollywood, so they arranged and they had the wedding right there in the Middle Easton in that church, which is now the parking lot of the Safeway store.
Oh.
And Gary Cooper was the best man, and the cast showed up as the guests, and that's something that's been forgotten, but that was a little brush of Hollywood in Easton in the 1920s.
Oh, wonderful, John. Listen, so our listeners can follow us a little bit. Give us a bit of the structure of your book. For instance, you have a division. You talk about some of the famous homes that were built and the mysteries behind these homes, and then you move on to churches or cathedrals. Houses of God is the section, and then. And then you talk about halls of the state and so on.
Well, the idea behind that, I wasn't sure how to organize all this because they're scattered not only all over the world, but in all different uses and things like that. And at first I was going to say, well, I'll do it by continent or east and west and all. But then the sections would have been much different. One would have had like two or three and one would have had 20. So I finally wound up grouping them by general types of buildings because several there's two churches there that have very parallel histories, Chartres and in France and St. Basil's in Moscow. Both of those churches, built at different times, different architecture, different everything, were in danger of destruction, slated for destruction, and were saved by the actions of one man each time. So I thought, well, that's sort of a parallel. So I have all the churches together, and I think private business-type buildings, high-rises, that type of thing are together as well. I'm not sure what the ideal way is because there's no continuity. You can read anything anywhere in the book by itself. It's self-contained. Nothing's dependent on anything else.
Well, I noticed that from municipal buildings that you call halls of the state, for instance, and you move on to commercial buildings or buildings of commerce, and then in continuing kind of with the structure of the book here, because we're going to hit on a number of these. You then go to other structures. You talk about the famous bridges that were built, and you have a story which we'll talk about the Chesapeake Bay Bridge in our area as well, and then the canals that we're familiar with and the towers and monuments. as well. So that's kind of the structure of your book. How did you find all of these structures, and how did you do the research? How did you dig the dirt on these structures?
Well, some, of course, just stumbled onto or happened to know about or hear about. One on which I didn't include is Hilltop House in Harper's Ferry, which was also an inspiration because if people have any familiarity with that, that was an active place not that many years ago, and now it's literally falling apart, but it has a rich history. So I knew these buildings existed, and I had known, one thing I've found out just from, by being interested in history is anything that's well known and is in a central place, like the Eiffel Tower or something like that, is bound to have a lot of weird stories behind it. It's just accumulated them all over the years. So some of those, I figured they probably had something, and I dug it out. Books, internet, even tourist sites would tell you about it. And other ones I found out, for instance, Thousand Islands, there are several castles were built up there by wealthy people. And I had a couple of contacts up there from when we went on vacation up there. And I talked to some of those people, talked to one of the caretakers that takes care of one of these places now. So it's a lot of assorted things like that. We visited as many as we could have, been on a couple of cruises, went to some of these places in Russia and the Baltic. So it's a mixed bag of things. But once, and some buildings or structures I found out about, and I'm trying to give you an example, I can't think of one off the top of my head, really didn't have a whole lot that was interesting about them or had things which I couldn't verify. Some of these things that I heard didn't pan out. Great Wall of China. Everybody says, oh, it's the only structure you can see from the moon. Well, I've checked that out. I found out, well, no, you can't see it from the moon. It's long, but it's very thin. That wasn't true.
I think you said in your story, like looking for a hair a mile away.
It's the equivalent of seeing a single human hair about two blocks away. Well, it doesn't matter how long the hair is. You're still not going to see
right.
it. Well, the wall is long, but it's not very wide.
Right.
Some of them are partially true. For instance, I hear a rumor, there's a system of tunnels under Disney World that Mickey Mouse can get from one area to the other without being seen. They can collect garbage. It made sense. But it turns out, yes, there is, but they're not. But what was to me was most interesting is they're not really tunnels. That's the first floor. Because Disney's not going to dig a hole in a swamp and then have to dewater it forever. So they're actually the first floor. And when you're walking down Main Street in Disney World, you're on the second floor. But with all the landscaping, you can't really tell. So some things I found were true, some things found weren't true. There's just so many stories swirling around. And the older a place is, of course, the more it accumulates.
John, you said that you started your research a while back. How did you use the internet to help you with your research? And did you, in fact, start your research before the internet?
Yes, well before, or I would some of these things I would have found out a lot easier. Some of the things when I was looking for historical era, there was a time about 2002, 2003, something there where things started to get digitized and available on the web. Prior to that, it wasn't. Something as reasonably simple as looking up a newspaper article, for instance. So I heard something happened here on a certain date, roughly. Gee, I wonder what the newspapers had to say about it. Well, they don't have files of stacks of newspapers anywhere that I know of, but the New York Times has they used to keep very good records. But up until it got digitized just a few years ago, they would put out a book every year with an index of all the articles for that year. And you look up the size of a large phone book, if people remember what phone books were. And when you found an article, it was alphabetized. It would tell you what edition it was in and what page and all. Then you go to the microfilm and look it up, and you put it in a microfilm reader. So this is a somewhat tedious process, and it might not be what you wanted anyway, and then you start over again. Well, now you can go on at home through usually public library and find some of these things. When I started, it was not as easy to find out things. The other thing the internet has done, in addition to giving you databases, some of these places which are tourist-oriented, like Eiffel Tower, Tower of London, something like that, have their own websites which have historical background on them. Or Wikipedia is a good, you know, Wikipedia gets a bad rap because if you go on Wikipedia with anything controversial, anything political, you'll get all kinds of crazy stuff. But if you get on something that's fairly straightforward, like a public building, the information is very good, and they'll have references at the bottom of other sources and links to them. So you can just keep building that way. And it's very good to get different sources, because sometimes I'd find stories that really sound like they were too good to be true, and then turns out they were. I found a site that talked about, get to the Great Wall of China again. Part of it was built underwater. And they were raving about how clever the engineers were to build it underwater. And I'm thinking, why would they build it, even if they could, why would they build it underwater? It's supposed to keep out the Huns. Or it's supposed to keep out the Mongols. Well, the Mongols didn't have scuba gear, as far as I know. So why would you need a wall? Well, as it turns out, when I found enough sources, yes, there is a part fully built underwater, but it wasn't underwater when they built it. Centuries later, they built a dam downstream, and it built up, and that's what happened. So it's good to have multiple sources, because you can't always trust what you get from one.
Well, I want to ask you to give our listeners a little bit of the flavor of these stories about structures and cathedrals and bridges and so forth. Would you? They're not terribly long, but even though they are terribly interesting, they're not terribly long. Would you pick one to read to us? And because they're not super long, read the whole thing if you would.
Well,
what are you going to read to us?
Maybe St. Basil's Cathedral.
Oh, okay.
I think that's not bad.
Then I have a couple of questions for you about St. Basil's Cathedral.
Okay. Most people, if they're not familiar with the name, they would recognize it in an instant. It's the cathedral in Red Square in Moscow that has the big onion domes and all the multicolors and everything.
John, anyone who has watched television news today,
yes,
has seen St. Basil's,
okay,
Cathedral in the background of all of the information,
yeah,
about
the, yes,
about Russia and sure, what's going on with Russia today.
That's one of the things a TV reporter always stands in front of.
That's right, exactly.
Show you there. All right, St. Basil's Cathedral, Russia. Here's the article. St. Basil's Cathedral on Red Square in Moscow is one of the most recognizable structures in the world. Officially called the Cathedral of the Intercession of the Virgin by the Moat, the bright colors and onion-shaped domes are familiar from movies and travel posters. Despite its official name, the church is called St. Basil's in honor of Basil the Blessed, a local commoner and religious zealot who is thought to predict the future and is often referred to as a, quote, fool for Christ, unquote. Basil is buried in the cathedral, so well known as St. Basil's that the Chinese built a full-scale replica in Jalimar near the Russian border. The inside, however, is a children's museum. And you can look that up on the internet, by the way, and find a picture of it, and you say, what is that doing there in the middle of the plain? There's nothing around it. St. Basil's has become the symbol for Moscow and for Russia itself. What may be less familiar, however, is that St. Basil's was almost intentionally destroyed twice in its history. Once it was saved by, to what may only be called divine intervention, the other by the brave act of one man. St. Basil's was built by Ivan the Terrible to commemorate a victory over the Tartars at Kazan. The famous onion domes were there from the beginning, but the entire cathedral was painted in plain colors until more recently, white with gold domes. The bright colors were added 200 years later. The famous onion domes, which served to shed snow, were fabricated from sheet metal placed on wooden frames. The cathedral has seen a lot of history. It has even been part of it. When Napoleon and the Grand Army invaded Russia in 1812, he reached Moscow and used the church as a stable for his cavalry horses. Upon leaving Moscow, Napoleon ordered that the cathedral be blown up, but it didn't happen. Accounts vary. Some say there was no time, but most popular explanation is that divine intervention in the form of a sudden rainstorm doused the fuses to the black powder charges. In the 1930s, another dictator tried his hand at destroying St. Basil's. This time, Stalin decided the church was in the way of ever grander parades across Red Square. Since he wasn't a fan of religion in the first place, he ordered it raised through Kazaganovich, his first secretary. Since no one ever said no to Stalin, the cathedral was doomed. This time, however, the savior was an ordinary man in the form of Pyotr Baranovsky, a well-known local architect and historical preservationist. With the courage bordering on suicidal, Baranovsky wrote a letter to Stalin threatening to chain himself to the doors and kill himself if any attempt was made to destroy St. Basil's. There are different versions of the story with varying degrees of recklessness on Baranovsky's part. Suffice to say, Baranovsky objected and therefore made himself a target of Stalin's wrath. This was in the 1930s, so this was not a good time to do that. Usually saying no to Stalin was a good way to get a one-way ticket to the nearest graveyard, but for some reason Stalin held back. Baranovsky was not executed, but was sent to Siberia for 5 years. This was a light punishment in those days. Almost everyone was sent to Siberia, even people just trying to mind their own business and get by. But an even stranger thing happened. The cathedral was not demolished. Whether it was because of Baranovsky, or a change of heart of Stalin, or just the cumbersome inefficiency of the state, the cathedral remained, saved from destruction once again. So that's the St. Basil's Cathedral stories.
Excellent. John, you had mentioned earlier that you did travel in Russia.
Yes.
And I'm assuming that you went to St. Basil's. And
We were in St. Petersburg.
Oh, okay.
And I have a section in there about the Winter Palace, which is an interesting thing to see.
But you didn't get to Moscow.
No.
Then.
No. I try to notice some of the little strange details. And one of the things I noticed at the Winter Palace, which is in the book, big, massive, beautiful thing, but it's been burned a couple of times. It's had its troubles, too. As big as that is and as important as that museum is, it has a whole room full of Rembrandts. Apparently, it doesn't seem like it's air-conditioned, because when we were there, there were windows open. It was a hot day. All the pollution of the city was there, and they have windows open to this place. It was built originally without any bathrooms, and fortunately they have them now because they do have tourists. But there's a lot of crazy details like that. For instance, they're in Russia. It's really cold. Well, they didn't have central heating. They have fireplaces, but the fireplaces were porcelain. They look like, you know, gigantic Delft porcelain things. And no way of putting any wood in them that I could see. And I found out later the fireplace is open to the inside of the walls, and servants would go through spaces between the walls and tend the fireplace that way, so the nobles didn't have to worry about the ashes or things like that. So there's a lot of strange details.
But what
like
happened
that.
To the Rembrandts? Tell us about
the Rembrandts are
the
still there.
Are they still there?
In pretty good, pretty good shape. But the museum was originally Catherine the Great's private collection, and of course, it got expanded over the years. And some museums would be happy to have a Rembrandt, but they've got a whole room full of them there, including ones that you've seen. It's weird going through that museum because if you keep seeing paintings, it's, oh, yeah, I've seen that before. Oh, yeah, I've seen that one. And it's like you're walking through a magazine or something. Mm. All these famous things you've seen, well, that's where a lot of them are.
I had the opportunity to travel during my working days to a number of Russian cities. Unfortunately, I never made it to St. Petersburg, which I understand is the most beautiful city because it was built on Western style of architecture. Is that what you found in St. Petersburg?
Well, it was very heavy French influence because Peter the Great, of course, started, and he was very much influenced, as everyone was at that time, the 1700s, by the French style. The buildings were very much like that. Yeah, there are palaces and, you know, cheek by jowl all the way down the street. A lot of it's been restored. A lot of it, of course, had that famous 900-day siege during World War II. If you go out of the city, and we went to one of the palaces, which is a little further out, called the Catherine Palace, which is the Germans actually occupied that. And near there, there's a place where they set up the artillery to fire into the city. And you can see it. You go by on the bus, and there's a ridge there. And they say, well, that's where they set up their guns. And if you look around, you can see there's the city. They say there's sitting ducks. They're sitting right there. Some places in St. Petersburg, there are old bronze plaques on certain streets telling you to stay on one side of the street and you're less likely to get hit by an artillery shell. It's all Russian, of course. So they had a lot of destruction. The Catherine Palace itself was pretty much a burned-out hulk. An entire room was stolen. There was an amber room, maybe just purely made of amber. Germans stole the entire room, and nobody knows, you know, where it is. Who's got it? But a lot of all that stuff's been restored, and it's the Tsar has lived large, and the nobility, and he pretty much everyone had to go there. Peter the Great didn't broke a whole lot of back chat. He wanted everybody to do what he said, and he wanted that to be his capital. And he wanted everybody to go there, and that's where they went. So a lot of the big buildings you see in St. Petersburg were really built by the nobility to tag along with Peter the Great.
Well, I did have the opportunity to go in St. Basil's and walked through the rooms. And one of the things that struck me, it's of course a beautiful structure from the outside. Inside, you almost have to turn sideways in the stairways to go up. Everything is so crowded and so narrow that it was quite an interesting experience to walk through the rooms and climb the stairways in St. Basil's.
One of the things I found with religious buildings is, depending on the type of religious services held, the buildings were designed for that. The cathedrals, where everybody comes in there, has huge soaring spaces, and you're supposed to look up and, you know, think of God. If you go to Indian temples, mostly they weren't, only the priest went in there, so the spaces are fairly small and cramped. But the outside is just spectacular with statues, life-size statues, carved out of granite, no less. And things like that. So I think St. Basil's probably is the same deal. They didn't expect to have huge crowds of people in there.
Well, you mentioned that the Tsars lived large, and at the end of your book, you note that there are a number of structures that you could have selected that you didn't. And so my question is, how did you decide which buildings to include in your book?
I tried to concentrate on ones which either were very well known to people already, or if they weren't well known, they were in there because they had a really unusual or compelling story. I tried to stick with buildings that are public in the sense that you can either go into them, like a municipal-type buildings, or can be easily seen. You know, if something's in the middle of a forest somewhere, one is interested. I wanted to be accessible, in other words. So that was the mix I tried to get. And some of the stories, I think, are compelling. And I liked particularly ones where you think you know the story, but maybe you don't. And Eiffel Tower is one. Everybody knows about the Eiffel Tower. And if you've ever been to Paris, you can hardly get away from it, because you go in any souvenir place and you get keychains and, you know, and refrigerator magnets and everything else. It's probably one of these popular structures in the world as far as its likeness being made. But at the time it was built, which was a centerpiece for a World's Fair, or a World Exposition at the time, the 1880s, it was a scandal to the bien passants of Paris. The artists, authors, and people like that were signed a petition that the thing shouldn't be built, should be torn down. It's an eyesore, it's out of scale, it's a big pile of rusty scrap metal, it doesn't go with anything in Paris, and it's making us the laughingstock. And I think I said in the book, said, well, if all the intellectuals didn't like it, well who did? And the answer is everybody else. It was supposed to be temporary. It was supposed to be torn down after the exposition. They said, well, we'll keep it up a little longer, but everybody just was so enamored of it that it stayed there, and of course it's still there. And I tell the story in the book about it was even sold for scrap once by a con man who got here's the 1920s again. A lot of stuff happened in the 20s. 1927, a guy by the name of Victor Lustig set himself up as a representative of the French government, and he contacted a bunch of scrap metal dealers in Paris to a secret meeting. And he said, look, the government wants to tear this thing down, let out the contract, and you guys can bid on it if you give me a down payment now. And they're thinking, hey, there's a lot of scrap metal in there. So he gets down payments from these people, and he even got a bribe from one of them. And then he disappeared. And they were all too embarrassed to report it once they realized what had happened. He thought it was a good idea, so he tried it again. Well, this time his new victims weren't embarrassed, and he wound up in jail. And I also tell the story about when the Germans came to town, and Hitler wanted to go up to the top and have his picture taken looking over the city. The French said, well, gee, the elevators aren't working. It's broken. And they were not fixed for the rest of the occupation. And one German private was given the task of going up to the top and putting the German flag up there. There's like something like 1,200 steps. And he gets to the top, he puts the flag up, he comes all the way down again. The wind comes up, tears the flag out. They said, oh, now you got to put up a smaller one. So he goes all the way up again. So all through the occupation, the elevators didn't work. Germans had to go all the way up the steps if they wanted to climb the tower. Strangely enough, as soon as the Allies took Paris over, the elevators started working again.
Well, that's the way it
always
goes.
One of the first people up there had the French flag.
That's right. That's right. Did I read, or am I imagining this, John, that the Eiffel Tower played a role at all in the preservation of Paris during the occupation? Because the city was slated to be destroyed, and the charges were set. Obviously the foundations were drilled. And yet, it wasn't blown up.
Yeah, the general in charge, whose name escapes me at the moment, there's a book called "Is Paris Burning," which documents that.
That's a magnificent book. And, by the way, to our listeners out there, I highly recommend "Is Paris." Festung Paris. I highly recommend that book to you.
And
yes.
The authors wrote another one about the partition of India called, I can't remember what that was called. Anyway, same thing, just highly detailed and yet compelling and just everything. Anyway, yeah, he was given the order to destroy Paris when a big Gotterdammerung where the whole thing was going to go down. And there have been a couple of good movies about it. I don't know how true they are, where he's sort of doing a to be or not to be sort of a thing. And he says, geez, I don't want to disobey orders, but I really want to be the guy who goes down history as destroying Paris. I don't know about the Eiffel Tower specifically, but I know he's thinking and says, well, there's a lot of good stuff here. I don't know if I want this on my conscience. For whatever reason, he held off, and of course, Hitler was fit to be tied, and he's going to hang the guy if he ever caught him, which he never did. And he surrendered to the Allies. And, you know, the French were like, you know, spitting on him and throwing rocks at him and all this kind of stuff without realizing he's the guy that saved Paris.
Right. Gustav Eiffel.
Freedom at Midnight. That's the other book.
Oh, okay. Good.
Freedom at Midnight.
Okay. Good. Gustav Eiffel went to jail also, didn't he? He had some legal problems. The designer of the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah, not because of that. He was involved also with the Suez Canal. Before Americans got involved, the French were trying to dig the canal under de Lesseps, who was the guy who...
And you write about the canal in the book as well.
Yeah, he had done the Suez Canal before that, which was, in a way, a lot easier, partly because he had almost slave labor, because the Khedive of Egypt was getting his people to do it for free. Anyway, Eiffel was involved to design the gates for the locks, and he designed. He was a well-known engineer of steel structures. He had a couple bridges. There's a movie called The Cassandra Crossing, which is about terrorists blowing up a big arch bridge in France, and it blows up at the end. It's a model, actually. Well, that was one of his bridges, too. Anyway, he designed these gates for the locks, for the Suez Canal that the French were building, but it never really quite got that far. The French had to give up. and they left it. But there was some mismanagement of money and a lot of things like that. It was one of those deals where everybody was getting dragged in, everybody was getting sued. Eiffel did not go to jail, but he was besmirched by it. There's no evidence that he was involved in any of this kind of stuff because they never actually built the stuff that, that he had designed. So yeah, he was involved in that. And then the Eiffel Tower was his grand thing. And he also designed the framework for the Statue of Liberty. Statue of Liberty, as you know, is copper sheets. Well, something's got to hold that up. And he designed a framework, which doesn't sound like a big deal, except that if you look at the Statue of Liberty, that's not, it's got an arm sticking up, it's got all kinds of angles and things, and it's all got to fit. And it has to be designed so that each piece that hangs on it is supported and overlaps in a way that can expand and contract. It wasn't an easy thing to do, but he designed that too. So Eiffel was did some pretty. He also has he also put an apartment in the Eiffel Tower for himself when he came to town. It's a very small apartment up on about the fourth level. You can look through an aperture there and see inside. So it's not a very big apartment, but you can't beat the view.
Well, John, you write about the Statue of Liberty as well. And Gustav Eiffel designed the superstructure for the copper-clad statue. Tell us some more about the Statue of Liberty, if you would.
The Statue of Liberty has to do with a fellow by the name of Friedrich Bartholdi, who was a Parisian sculptor who specialized in big statues. And he has several of them. Actually, they're in Washington, D.C., and he, when he was a young man, he took a trip to the Middle East, and he looked at some of the big Egyptian stuff there, and he was inspired by that. And he thought he liked to make big statues. And one of the things he was really interested in was the Colossus of Rhodes, which, of course, was no longer there. It was a statue which actually supposedly straddled the entrance to the harbor at Rhodes, and of a man holding up a torch, and the torch was burning, and that was a navigation signal. So his idea, as the Eiffel Tower was being, as the Suez Canal was being completed in the 1860s, he proposed a statue, something like the Colossus of Rhodes, for the Suez Canal. It would be a navigation beacon and also a light. And it was a woman holding up a torch. And it was going to be right at the entrance to the canal, and people coming from the Mediterranean would see it. And because Egypt was sort of, nominally at least, in charge, it was going to be called, I believe it was Egypt Enlightening Asia or something like that, because the idea would be it provided access to Asia. And he pitched the idea, and by that time they had gotten deep enough, figuratively and literally, into the canal that they didn't want to hear about it. So he said, okay, I like the idea. Nobody wants to do it. He sort of put it on the shelf. But some years later, when the French were talking about some sort of a gesture for American liberty and for the French involvement in the American Revolution, he bent some of the right ears and he got in with some people who liked the idea. So he changed the statue idea around a little bit. He took the basic Egyptian statue he was going to and changed it around, made it bigger, and instead of Egypt enlightening Asia, it was liberty enlightening the world. And that became the Statue of Liberty. So I say in the book that the Statue of Liberty has relatives in Egypt. There's a Bartholdi Museum in France, and in that they have his prototypes, just models, like about 2 feet high, of about three different statues that were going to be at the entrance to the Suez Canal, but never happened.
Well, there is a smaller version of the Statue of Liberty in France as
yes.
well.
Yeah, right by the Eiffel Tower. Yes, there is, and it's kind of jarring. We were there and took a boat ride, down the Seine, and you're seeing all this stuff, and there's the Eiffel Tower and all, and there's the Statue of Liberty. So what? I don't know what scale is. It's considerably smaller, but it's not small though. It's there. It was, for a while, they had the torch and I think the head on display because it took them a while to raise the money to do it. And then there was no place to put it. And they found a fort in New York Harbor and they raised the money. In fact, the base of the Statue of Liberty that with the point sticking out, that was partly the fort at the time. School kids raised their pennies and all, and they built the base and it was built.
Well, I remember I missed a turn on the Periphérique around Paris. So I passed this smaller Statue of Liberty twice on my circuit.
I thought you were really lost.
I did. I figured the only way to find my turn again was to go around again, and there was the Statue of Liberty one more time. One small incident about the Statue of Liberty that you didn't mention in your book that I wondered if you ran across was the face on the Statue of Liberty.
Yes, it was Bertoldi's mother. But,
yeah, exactly. Yes. It was Bertoldi's
mention that.
Put the mother on his face.
I came across some things, but with the... there's been a lot of stuff about the Statue of Liberty, and that has been written about a bunch. I want to find things that weren't quite... a little more obscure, put it in other words. But yeah, I do remember that. It was his mother. And there's... All kinds of things. I think I mentioned there's a sculpture garden on the island, and there are sculptures of Bertoldi, and I can't remember the name of a fan, another French gentleman who was sort of his sponsor, who was a big America fan, who the two of them sort of got Statue of Liberty accepted.
Well, John, a little closer to home, you talk about early in the book, the structures you talk about, the Gilded Age in America, and in reading these stories about falling waters and about another of the huge houses and homes that were built. And you mentioned earlier the ones on the Thousand Islands.
Yes.
that were built there. Tell us a little bit about this era, or at least this period, and then choose one of these stories to read for us, if you don't mind.
Well, the Gilded Age is generally the end of the last century and the early part of this century, and a bunch of things came together. There was very young industries, steel industry, railroads, and which the country expanded needed, and which were just being developed anyway. So the door was wide open for people to get into things like that, and with the Vanderbilts and Carnegie. I have one of the houses I have in there was built by Frick, and Frick was a partner of Carnegie and Carnegie Steel in Pittsburgh. And they, just kept building and building and amassed vast amounts of money. And it was also the days before the income tax. So they got to keep it and spend it on what they wanted. And one of the things that they spent it on, and some of them, there are people who really got off on having a gigantic house to dazzle everybody. And there were other ones that didn't really care about it all that much. But one of the things among in their circle was to have a big house and for entertaining, if nothing else. Some of the New York parties are famous for one of them, though, was I don't know what the theme was, but everybody came on a horse in the house. Multi-course dinners and costumes and all this crazy stuff. So they wanted big houses for entertaining and that type of thing. And there wasn't a whole lot, and there was a lot of labor available. A lot of immigrants were coming in. And so it was just a time when everything sort of came together for that type of deal. And some of them were doing it as a way of, lording it over some of their competitors. Some of them developed rivalries. Frick and Carnegie had a falling out, and there's a book which I used about this rivalry. They were partners, and they both got wealthy together. And there was a strike, a very nasty strike there. People got killed and all this kind of stuff. Anyway, the title of the book is, and it's a quote, it says, "I'll see you in hell." And it was for, I don't remember which one said it to the other one, but one of them sent a conciliatory note, and that's what the other one said. A building that I didn't include was there's a office building, two office buildings in downtown Pittsburgh right now, which one of them was built by Carnegie and one was built by Frick. And Carnegie, I believe, built his first. Frick got the lot next door. And in those days where the zoning laws were kind of loosey-goosey, he built a building in such a way that it blocked out all the sunlight from Carnegie's building. And when you have a lot of money you can do that sort of thing. There was a lot of building going on and a lot of fancy stuff. And that's where a lot of the great art collections started. Frick is the guy for the Frick Museum. His wife actually started collecting stuff, and they have there's on the same property that has his house, which I write about in the book, there's a museum that they built, just as their private art gallery, which is now the Frick Museum. And there's another one in New York.
Well, which one of these barons are you going to read about for us here, John?
Well, the one that I kind of like is, let's see, is Ohiga. Now, people may say, well, I've never heard of that. Well, you will if you've... It was in a Taylor Swift video.
which one is
Ohiga
this?
Ohiga Castle in New York on Long Island.
Uh-huh.
And the person built is Otto Hermann Kahn. He was a financier and also a manager of railroads and that type of thing. Very wealthy. And the thing I think is compelling about that, he built it almost for spite. It's the second biggest hotel. That's how big it is. It's the second biggest private house in the United States.
Well, read about it for us.
And the thing I really like about this guy is he was the model for the Monopoly Man. Mustache.
Yeah.
Ohiga Castle, New York. Almost everyone's played Monopoly and is familiar with the cartoon Monopoly Man. This dapper figure with his top hat, mustache, and monocle is the very image of the plutocrat. Most people assume the figure is simply a mascot. But the Monopoly Man is based on a real person, not surprisingly, a very rich person. Otto Hermann Kahn was an immigrant from Germany who rose from humble bank clerk. And this is an interesting thing. A lot of these people didn't start off with money, but, you know, they got in the right place at the right time, and they wound up with a lot of it. Otto Hermann Kahn was an immigrant from Germany who rose from humble bank clerk, then a hussar in the Kaiser's army. He became the head of the second largest bank in New York. In addition to being a financier, he was also a skilled manager and reorganized some of the country's major railroads, including the Union Pacific and the Baltimore and Ohio. As if he wasn't busy enough, Kahn was also a patron of the arts. Here we go with the arts again. He originally wanted to be a musician and learned to play several instruments. He lived in Morristown, New York for a time, but grew increasingly disenchanted with restrictions and snubs he had to endure because of being Jewish. Finally, Kahn determined to build a gigantic home in Huntington, New York, on Long Island's Gold Coast. And one of the reasons for this was he wasn't allowed in the country club there. And he said, well, I'm going to build my own country club. His home in Morristown later became corporate headquarters for the Honeywell Corporation. So he didn't have a shack there either. First thing to be done was to build a hill on which to place the house so it would be the highest point on Long Island. Between 1914 and 1919, when the First World War raged in Europe, Kahn's new home rose on a 443-acre property. The house, I think it's bigger than Manhattan. It's pretty close. The house had 127 rooms and covered 106,000 square feet. That's over 2 acres of indoor space, making it the second largest private residence in America. Only the Vanderbilt estate in Asheville, North Carolina, was bigger. The estate includes a large formal garden and lots of woods and wildlife. Some of the neighbors grumbled that the house was too ostentatious, especially with the war in Europe going on. To mollify the critics somewhat, Kahn abandoned plans for an orangery, sort of a greenhouse for growing fruit trees, and built an indoor lap pool instead. The house was modeled after the French castles of the Loire Valley and was named Ohiga after the first letters of the name Otto Hermann Kahn. Kahn lived in the house for 15 years and was famous for lavish parties and entertainment. Many of the big names of the day were his guests, people such as Charlie Chaplin and a string of celebrities from the world of arts and entertainment. Oddly enough, Mrs. Kahn spent little time in the house, preferring to travel in Europe instead. This is unusual. Very often it was the wives who were very big on this stuff while the husband was off at the office. About the same time Kahn was building his massive estate on Long Island, he was also building a house in New York City on a property on 91st Street he obtained from Andrew Carnegie. This house was an 80-room Italian Renaissance mansion based on the Piazza della Cancelliera in Rome. Kahn died in 1934, and Ohika was sold to become, among other things, a rest home for New York sanitation workers. In 1946, an adjacent country club was bought, did buy the golf course and stables. He had, didn't mention that, he had golf course and stables there. In 1948, the property was sold again and became a military academy. And the academy closed its door in 1979, and the property stood vacant, the target of over 100 arson attempts. Finally, Gary Melius, a local developer, bought and restored it to create the present-day Ohika Hotel and Conference Center. Melius had financial problems. In 1988, he was forced to sell the property to a Japanese company, but was able to buy it back again for $30 million in 1998. The present building is a much sought-after venue for weddings and has seen celebrity nuptials of many well-known names, including Megyn Kelly and Anthony Weiner, but not to each other. Ohika has appeared as Xanadu, Charles Foster Kane's home in Citizen Kane, and has appeared in numerous movies, TV shows, and music videos. As an odd footnote to the Ohika story, present owner Gary Melius was shot in the head in an apparent assassination attempt on the grounds in February of 2014. He survived, and the police questioned his stepson extensively, but so far the case remains open and no one was ever arrested.
Yeah, I think I remember that.
Yeah, That is a place which is just a massive conference center, castle, last word, luxury. If you go on their website, you can see, you know, all this stuff.
And you selected that because it's so huge. That's the odd thing about it.
Well, I think his story, I couldn't resist the Monopoly Man. I mean, gee whiz.
That's exactly right.
I like that part of it. And I like
that's
the part,
right.
And I like the part that he basically couldn't get into the country club. He said, oh, okay, I'll build my own. And he built this massive thing because he had money to do it. And that wasn't his only home. He also had one in New York City, which is bigger than most people ever dream of. So that was, also the cusp of the golden age, I suppose. But he wasn't an industrialist, really. But people with hotels did very well. There's a castle in the Thousand Islands on Hart Island. It was hotel you built that, and it was he built it for his wife. I have that in there too.
In the Thousand Islands seemed to be an attractive venue.
Well, it's
for
a beautiful place, and you can be on an island, just everybody leave you alone. Kind of expensive to build there because you got to haul everything out, and the season is very short because it freezes over and everything else.
It didn't mean anything to them, though.
There's only one left there that was actually occupied, and that is Singer Castle on Dark Island. I mean, it just sounds like just a place you'd want to have a castle. And it was built by the president of Singer Sewing Machine Company. And I put in the book, it says the castle built by sewing machines, which is not much of an exaggeration because that's what it is, as a hunting lodge. You go up there and stay in the castle and go, I don't know what he was hunting because he's on an island. And you can go up there today on a tour. And if you would like, you can actually pay extra, quite a bit extra, to stay the night in the castle in the master suite. I'm not sure if they're, making their payments by doing that, but that's what they do. So there's tourist attractions now, but they were remnants of people with golden age.
Remnants of opulence.
Yeah. Yes.
Let's move a little closer to home. Even than the Thousand Islands and New York. And you write about Tilghman Island.
Yes.
What in the world is going on with Tilghman Island?
The thing on Tilghman Island I thought was kind of interesting.
First of all, for our listeners that aren't from the immediate area, where is Tilghman Island? Just to give us some context here, John.
Tilghman Island is on sort of a hanging off the end of the peninsula that has St. Michael's. If you drive, if you go to Easton off Route 50 and you go down to St. Michael's and you keep on driving almost equal distance, you'll come to Tilghman Island, and it's a drawbridge, and then you go across and run Tilghman Island. Tilghman Island was a very big oystering center, both harvesting them and packing them. And Tilghman Island had a big packing house operation there. It had hundreds of people, supplied a lot of food for the armed forces during World War II.
This was a period, an era in which oystering was a very, very productive agricultural pursuit.
This was also during the Golden Age. It was kind of a Golden Age around here, too, right. Not the opulent age. But
right.
The great thing about the packing houses was that, I mean, you didn't get rich working there, but you needed no education, no background. You just walk in the door and, bam, they put you to work. And it was piecework. The more you packed, the more money you made. And said, "Well, I'm tired of work. I'll send go away for a month and come back and get the job back." Well, anyway, this all started back in the last century with the steamboats. And the steamboats is how you got around on the Eastern Shore, because no one had cars and the roads were terrible, made out of crushed oyster shells, actually, not a lot of them. And on Tilghman Island, there was a long pier. And you need a long pier because the water tended to be shallow to get out to it. And there was a long pier that had the steamboat stop on the end if you wanted to get to or from Tilghman Island. And all the oystermen would ship their stuff out of there. Well, somebody got the idea that, well, we could do some packing right here and don't have to pay to ship out all these heavy shells. So they built some little packing shacks on I'm going to call stilts, actually piles, sticking up out of the water about halfway along that pier. And they would pack the stuff and then stick them right on the steamboat and send them off to market. Well, over time, as they were shucking the oysters, well, you get a lot of shells. What do you do with the shells? Well, they're biodegradable, sort of. No, not exactly, but when they would shuck oysters, the shells were dropped through a hole in the floor into the water, and it just went down to the bottom. Well, after a while, it started piling up, and before you knew it, you had a little the water was actually had oyster shells sticking out of it, and it formed an island underneath the packing plant. And eventually, the island became almost an acre of island out there in the middle, so that when they took down the pier, they still had the island there. The packing company went out of business in the 1970s. There were some fires there, vandalism and all, and the place became an eyesore, derelict, and rats, everything you think of that was bad. So part of the deal when a developer came along was that they would build the development called Tilghman on Chesapeake, which is there now, a luxury development. Not everybody was crazy about the idea, but they really needed the economic activity. And part of the deal was that the people that developed it would renovate that island, would get all the derelict buildings off of it, would stabilize it, and would build a marina and yacht club there. And they did, and it's beautiful. And if you're there, you're walking around on an island made out of oyster shells. And you're walking on history. If you were to dig down a foot or so, there you'd be hitting oyster shells.
It's interesting that that this island is made out of oyster shells, because you can go back and look at the history of oystering in the Chesapeake Bay, and it's as fascinating as the building of this island. For example, well, John,
the Maritime Museum is the same story. Maritime Museum in St. Michael's is also on a peninsula, in this case, made out of oyster shells because there was a packing plant there.
I've been there a number of times, and I didn't realize.
Well, take
that,
a shovel,
John.
Next time.
I'll take a shovel.
You can find out.
I'd hate to have to dig in oyster shells, though. It might be a little difficult. Yeah. John, the secrets behind the structures is a wonderful book, and I'm sorry we only had time to kind of touch a little bit of what you have, the kind of treasures that you have in this book about the structures, and we didn't even get to the bridges at all. But I want to congratulate you on the book. I want to recommend it to our listeners, and I want to thank you very much for being on our program today.
Thank you. And I'm glad to talk about it anytime.
And I want to thank all of our listeners for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a special Writer's Edition of Delmarva Today with their host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.